Well, here's some information, by the way, on that story of the border agents. Incredible story as it is. Listen to this. Nearly 18 months after a violent encounter, the two agents are facing 20 years in federal prison for their actions. Why? Well, according to the U.S. attorney who successfully prosecuted the agents, the man they were chasing didn't actually have a gun. Shooting him in the back, they say, violated his civil rights. The agents didn't know for a fact that he was a drug smuggler, and they broke, they say, Border Patrol rules about discharging their weapons and preserving a crime scene. Even more broadly, according to Assistant U.S. Attorney, the two had no business chasing someone in the first place. Hey, it's their job to stop illegals from entering the country. Shooting someone in the back is one thing, of course, but it's their job. And how do they know who this individual is? You know, the person shouldn't have been there in the first place. In a moment, we'll be back. Glenn Kimball, our guest. Ancient manuscripts, artifacts. Get ready on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast and our guest, Glenn Kimball. Glenn Kimball has a Bachelor of Arts degree in journalism and MA in communications. In addition, he has successfully completed all coursework for PhD in communications, passing his doctoral exams. He was the former president of the International Exchange School, vice president of two cellular phone companies. Glenn has taught school at Southern Illinois University, not too far from the Cave here in St. Louis, and was ranked by student evaluators in the top 10 instructors at that university. He has been collecting ancient texts since the age of 15 and is famous for being able to integrate very diverse texts into a continuous storyline. He's our guest right now on Coast to Coast. Glenn, how are you? Welcome back.
Oh, I'm just fine. How are you, George?
I'm doing great. Lots of things have been going on since you were on with me.
Boy, I'd say.
Hey, so let's talk about a lot of things. Of course, the situation in the Middle East as it really dictates to the ancient manuscripts and ancient texts, if we can. What's your overall perspective, Glenn, of this?
Well, I think, first of all, since we announced this show, I've gotten 50 emails, over 50 emails, from individuals with every conceivable perspective possible. Israelis who were really sympathizers with the plight of the Islam people. Islam people who were sympathetic with the Israelis. Israelis who were sympathetic with Israelis. Every permutation imaginable. And I've gotten massive amounts of documentation from scholars and historians. People have all wanted me to include this material in the show tonight, and I've stood back almost like I was being attacked. This has been quite an unusual experience. You and I have talked on several occasions, many times before, and I've never had this kind of response. And the response is, you know, to be honest with you, George, I don't think we could pick any single perspective and not have the majority of the country and the world against us.
Well, you may be right, Glenn. That's true. I mean, is this a point where they're attacking you, the messenger?
Perhaps so. You know, I heard your show with Waleed Shubat, and I can't help but think that was probably one of the very best declarative interviews that I've ever heard in my life. And I leave most of the contemporary issues to that particular interview. What could a man say better than what he said? The only thing that we could add would be the historical agendas that are behind Islam.
And what we're doing, though, tonight, Glenn, I want to be able to protect you here, is, you know, we're talking about the historical perspective of events that have unfolded on this planet. You know, we're going to talk about the Bosnian pyramids, the Gospel of Judas, and also just, you know, to look at just what went on with the Sumerians and, you know, the Masonic order and everything. So I hope people understand that this is not the message of Glenn Kimball. And people shouldn't be attacking you because of your specific insight into things that have gone on.
Well, we're going to approach it from a very historical perspective, and I turned back amazingly enough to the last verse of the Old Testament to begin the show, and it was the prophecy done by Malachi the prophet, who said, "I will send Elijah the prophet before the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he shall turn the hearts of the children to the fathers, and the fathers to the children, lest I smite the earth with a curse." In essence, what Malachi was trying to say was the solutions for the problems that we have are contained in the history of our fathers. Our fathers knew, we don't like to admit that in our scientific age where we think that that the contemporaries were the ones that had the best solutions. The reality is that our fathers did a better job of this than we do. Certainly in the case of the conflict in the Middle East, what happened in the past was filled with heroes and filled with human rights issues. In fact, the model of the Iranian king, Cyrus, is perhaps the greatest model of human rights in history. I refer back to Shirin Ebadi, who was from Iran. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003. Now, that's after 9/11. She won the Nobel Peace Prize as an Iranian. Yep. And she says, "I am an Iranian, a descendant of Cyrus the Great. This emperor proclaimed at the pinnacle of power 2,500 years ago that he would not reign over a people if they did not wish it. He promised not to force any person to change his religion and faith and guaranteed freedom for all. The Charter of Cyrus the Great should be studied in human history as the pinnacle of human rights."
Where do the Sumerians stand with all this, Glenn?
Well, the Sumerians were the remnants of back when the Assyrians conquered the 10 tribes in the north. There were really two factions in Palestine, ancient Palestine. The Jews, remnant of the tribe of Benjamin in the south, and the 10 tribes in the north. The 10 tribes in the north were conquered by the Assyrians. The Assyrians did an amazing thing. They really only took the people out of the 10 tribes who were worthwhile to them, namely warriors and craftsmen. They completely emptied the country of all of the people who were engineers, craftsmen, stonemasons, people who could be warriors, but they left all of the weak and infirm and everyone else behind. And these people merged with the Sumerian cultures and became Sumerians themselves, and were dealt with by the Jews in the south as idolaters. And so when you talk about the Good Samaritan in the Bible, the Samaritans were very frowned upon, thought of as idolaters, thought as people who without value, when in reality they were remnants of the 10 tribes. As a matter of fact, when they built the second temple after the destruction of the Temple of Solomon, when Babylon came in and destroyed it, the Samaritans offered to help the Jews and Zerubbabel rebuild the temple. They wanted to help them build it. And Zerubbabel refused to allow them to build it, help them build it, rebuild it. As a matter of fact, they called on the king of Syria to intercede for them and to investigate Cyrus, this great Cyrus the Great, his royal archives and his royal decrees, to see if he had allowed them to build a temple. And in reality, he did not. He had given all of the rights to rebuild the temple to Zerubbabel and the Jews to the south. And so the decree came out that from Darius, who was the descendant of King Cyrus, that the Samaritans were not to be included in the rebuilding of the temple, even though they were parts of the 10 lost tribes. And that was a sad thing.
You know, it is amazing, Glenn, that here we are now, thousands of years later, and you just mentioned it. But phrases like, you know, he's a good Samaritan. I mean, these things, how do they occur? I mean, who carries the torch through centuries to keep phrases like that alive?
Well, certainly you're right on the money. The Samaritans were not bad people. They were not non-believers in Yahweh or Jehovah. They truly they mixed in with the Babylonian and the Syrian group of people who were not considered believers in Yahweh or Jehovah, and were therefore considered by Jews as pagans. But they were very much interested. They very much had the history of their people well intact. And, you know, the craftsmen and the warriors who were taken by the Assyrians and dragged all the way through Eastern Europe, up into Western Europe, up into the Northland and around, they retained their histories as well. As a matter of fact, the Isle of Iona off the coast of Scotland, which was the end point probably of the migrations of the Assyrians and the Ten Lost Tribes, that was the greatest library in the world in its day, bigger than the Library of Alexandria, bigger than the Vatican ultimately obtained, bigger than the libraries in Great Britain.
What happened to it? Where'd they go, the texts?
It was destroyed.
God. Burned everything, huh?
We're going to be doing some work on that in the future to help people understand what happened to the Ionians, the Isle of Ionia. But it's a great, marvelous story, a story of the greatness of a people who retained their traditions. And the Samaritans had the traditions. They had the traditions of their parents. You know what's amazing about this King Cyrus, I found to be totally interesting, was that we know in America here the name David Koresh.
Sure.
Not born David Koresh. He was born Vernon Wayne Howell. That's his original name. That was his birth certificate name. He adopted the name David Koresh after King Koresh or King Cyrus in an attempt. And King Cyrus wasn't a Jew. He certainly wasn't a Christian. Christians weren't around at that particular moment in history. He was a Babylonian pagan to some extent.
How old was he, Glenn? What do you think at that time?
David Koresh?
Cyrus.
Cyrus? He was an old man. He was probably in his 60s or 70s
okay.
when he made that
All
declaration.
Right. Okay.
He was the heir apparent to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the one that captured the Jews, but ultimately he died and gave way to Cyrus. Nebuchadnezzar did a smart thing, too. He did the very same thing the Assyrians did. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't interested in killing Jews, per se. He was interested in augmenting his armies and capturing the Gibelmites, or the stonemasons and the artisans, to help him build Babylon into even a more beautiful city than it was already there. These Gibelmites are very interesting characters. These people had technology and creative ability and artisan ability that was beyond what we have in our day today. They were stonemasons. And you know who the stonemasons in our day, who take after the stonemasons of their day, was our Masonic order.
And well, that's right. Which, by the way, many of our founding fathers of this country were part of that order, weren't they?
And they revere the Gibelmites as being the great stonemasons. And guess who else was a stonemason of great renown, world famous everywhere? Jesus.
Was he really?
The term carpenter from the Hebrew is a mistranslation. It really more accurately says stonemason. His father was a stonemason.
That's an interesting fact.
And he comes from the Gibelmite traditions, and he and his father in the Gospel of the Virgin Mary, which was acknowledged by the Vatican and the heads of the Episcopal faith in 1997, this ancient manuscript that is so beautiful, talks about Jesus and his father cutting stones and building buildings in Caesarea up in the north, which was the most modern city in the world with the most modern seaport in the world. And you have to ask yourself, why in the world would Rome build the most modern seaport in the world in Judea if all of our movies are correct, that these were poor little desert rats, you know?
Yeah.
That's a complete fabrication.
Absolutely. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, he's the one that Saddam Hussein has been so obsessed with, isn't he?
Without any question, that is right. He feels himself to be the rightful descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. But if he would have just turned to two generations later, under King Cyrus, he would have done the exact opposite. Because Cyrus not only released the Jews to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple, he gave them back all of the stolen artifacts from the Solomon's temple. He paid for the rebuilding of the temple. He paid the people to survive while they were in transition. He helped them build their homes again. Between him and his son and Darius, who was the next successor, they restored the people back to Ur, helped them rebuild their houses. He helped restore the people in the temples in Sais, Egypt, and gave them back their livelihoods. This guy was a human rights giant.
Glenn, 2,000 years ago, the area that today is Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, controlled by Romans, what did they call it? I mean, what did the Roman Empire call that region at that time, a couple thousand years ago?
Well, Judea. Some of them call Judea, but some of them call it Palestine, depending upon how large the area of territory you were looking at. But Judea. I don't know. You'd probably be able to tell me better than I could on that particular point. But Judea, it was the area to the west. This was the homeland of. There were two factions of Jews that were very prominent in that area during the lifetime of Christ. The Sadducees were there. They composed about 8% of the population. The Sadducees were primarily the civil servants. They were allies of Rome. They ran the public, the water systems, the jails, the local police force, all the civic things that were under their control.
Okay. The Sanhedrin, were they part
they were
of that?
All primarily, they were composed of both elements, but they were directed largely by the Annas, who for six generations, or at least six consecutive heads of the Sanhedrin. Annas was the first. He had five sons who were successive heads of the Sanhedrin, and his son-in-law Caiaphas, who was alive during the time of the crucifixion of Jesus. All of them were controlled by Annas, and he was a Sadducee. And by the way, these were the people who ran the government, but they were also making money off the people. They were paid by Rome, but they were the ones who owned the Bazaar of Annas, which was the money-changing tables outside the temple of the temple of Herod.
So they were the bankers of the time, I guess.
Well, actually, no. They were the thieves to some extent.
Well, maybe one of the same.
Well, people were paying their tithing. They were coming from all over the world to pay their tithes and offerings at the temple, and they had to pass through the Bazaar of Annas and convert their money into a suitable currency. And as a result, Annas personally was taking a tick off of every piece of the tithes and offerings from all the tithing paid from everybody in the world that was coming to the temple.
And greed always happening. So these people were the elitists of the time, I guess.
They were. And then you had the Pharisees, who occupied about 11% of the population, or 12% of the population. These were largely the independent merchants. There were seven categories of Pharisees, only one of which was really favorable to Jesus. But these were the entrepreneur spirits. These were the guys that owned their own companies.
All right.
So they were the ones trading back and forth. That's why Joseph of Arimathea was considered a Pharisee, because he was a great merchant.
Were these people wealthy in their own right?
They were extremely wealthy. The wealth was beyond measure. The wealth of the Temple of Herod was enough that when they conquered the temple, dismantled the temple in 70 AD, the Roman Empire came in and dismantled it. The reason why they dismantled it is when it was burnt to the ground, the gold off the walls and the silver off the walls melted between the stones, so they had to break the stones apart to get the gold and the silver out. They took all that back, and by the way, this history is on the Great Arch of Titus. They're right in front of the Colosseum in Rome. It's the story of the dismantling of the temple. That shows them taking the treasures back to Rome. They used that wealth to build the Colosseum.
That's amazing. Where'd this half hour go, Glenn? Stay with us. My gosh. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Well, if you're interested in the After Dark newsletter, where you can now get 14 issues for the price of 12, call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online, coasttocoastam.com, order it that way. The upcoming issue, we'll talk about how I almost went into the light. Oh, yes, a long time ago. Back in a moment with Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Glenn, through all your work and studies, did you ever investigate the Ark of the Covenant? I know old Lavendel Jones has been trying to find that for a long, long time. Did you do any work in that area?
Of course. Obviously, when the Babylonians conquered the Temple of Solomon and destroyed it, they did not take the Ark of the Covenant with them. We know that's true because if they had, King Cyrus would have returned it to the rebuilding of the second temple.
Right.
So it was not confiscated by the Babylonians. Remember when the prophets that were alive and responsible for the Ark of the Covenant, when the Babylonians came, it was Jeremiah, Daniel, and Ezekiel. Jeremiah principally was responsible for the Ark of the Covenant. If you read the Bible, Jeremiah escaped with the daughter of Zedekiah, who was the king. Zedekiah had been killed, and his sons had been killed. He escaped with the daughter, Tephi, and he escaped with the Ark of the Covenant in tow. The Bible tells us that he went to Ethiopia first, which is only logical because there was a temple in Ethiopia, or very close to Ethiopia, in Amarna, which was the birthplace of Akhenaten. He had built a temple identical to the Temple of Solomon there in Egypt. And so in his mind, he was saying, I'll take the Ark of the Covenant from one temple, and I'll put it in another temple because it was used for the same purpose. But by the time he got there, the priests of Amun had already desecrated the temple, been at war with the Pharaoh for 38 years, and so he couldn't leave it there. What he did do in order to be able to get it out of the country was he built a replica, which was called the Talbot, and he left it in Ethiopia, and we see all kinds of reports of this Talbot, the Ark of the Covenant, that's been left in Ethiopia and under lock and key, and Jeremiah leaves. Well, where does Jeremiah die? Where's his tomb? Well, Jeremiah, we know there's been a great book written called Irish Prince, Hebrew Prophet. Jeremiah dies in Ireland. It's on the tourism route. You can visit the tomb of Jeremiah.
Right.
He takes the daughter of Zedekiah with him to the British Isles, where the great ancestor of Jesus, Tephi, was born, and where his grandmother was born too, the great Saint Anna. And he takes the Ark of the Covenant to Ireland. But on his way to Ireland, he has a vision, which is recorded. Jeremiah says, he had a vision that says that he must turn to the left and the rest of his armada was to turn to the right. And, you know, if you exit the Rock of Gibraltar, you turn to the right, you go into the British Isles. You turn to the left, you head into the Atlantic Ocean. Well, now we have a little problem here, because where does he go with the Ark of the Covenant? Moses tells us the Ark of the Covenant rests at the feet of Mount Nebo in the valley of the crossroads of the Red, White, and Blue River, in the Valley of the Blue Shroud. That's where the Ark of the Covenant was to be rested. Most people thought that was somewhere in Saudi Arabia. And that is not true. He disappears for 2 years, and he goes to a place where he unloads the Ark of the Covenant and buries it at the feet of a Mount Nebo in a valley of three rivers in the Valley of the Blue Shroud. And the people who help him carry the Ark of the Covenant consider it holy. They have petroglyphs and paintings about them carrying the Ark, and they call themselves the Ark Nation. Now, who are the people of the Ark Nation? Do you have any clue?
Well, let's see. That's a quiz question for me, is it?
Hmm. Well, let me tell you that in their own language, they call themselves the Kansa, or the Ark Kansa. If you go to Arkansas to this day...
Wait a minute. Are you saying the Ark of the Covenant might be here?
Yes, sir. If you go to the Arkansas National Forest, these are the people who call themselves the Ark Nation. They have pictures of themselves carrying this Ark into battle with them. Here in America, Native American Indians. And if you go to the Arkansas National Forest to this day, you'll see on the map there's a Mount Nebo and the Valley of Three Rivers, which was once called the Valley of the Blue Shroud.
Interesting. And this happened then way before Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas.
I didn't invent this. I mean, there have been people digging in this Mount Nebo for a very, very long time. And some of the stories of them digging in there are really, really, I mean, mystical in nature. I mean, some of the experiences these people have had.
Do you think anybody has found the Ark of the Covenant?
I don't think so.
So it's still hidden away then in
And there's a reason why I came west. And, you know, if you go to the oldest manuscript that we have in the world, it's the lost stories of Eden, or the stories of Adam and Eve, which was written in Arabic, or actually in Sanskrit originally, but was translated from the Arabic. Adam and Eve lived in the Garden of Eden, but the Garden of Eden was not in this dimensional world as we know it. So how do we know where the heck the Garden of Eden was? I mean, the tradition has it that it was in Iraq.
Right.
Between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Well, according to this book, that's the east gate of the Garden of Eden. But if you read the lost books of Eden, you'll find out that Adam and Eve left the west gate, not the east gate. They exited, and they lived in the Cave of the Treasures. The Cave of the Treasures was nowhere in the Middle East. The cave systems that we have been so interested in over the years are in the Mississippi Valley.
I got to tell you, I mean, Glenn, here I am right now broadcasting out of St. Louis. I'm pretty darn close, then, to where this is.
Yes, sir, you are. And that's part of the reason why you see all those burial mounds and all those temple mounds.
Yes.
All these mounds in the Mississippi Valley, you don't see them anywhere else in the world.
They're all over the place. You're right.
And why is this place so sacred to the Native Americans? And why was it so sacred? I mean, these are old structures. Some of them date back to 2,500 years B.C. But this was a sacred spot. This was a... we have lost sight of the history of our own continent.
You know,
I know that's going to sound ridiculous to people. What I just said is going to sound ridiculous and preposterous. But if you get back to the original histories and track them out, you're going to find out that I'm not too far wrong.
And didn't you say once that there were hieroglyphs found in that region as well?
Absolutely. I've been there where the hieroglyphs are. The cave of the, there's a what on the Mississippi River there's a what is it called the cave of the mouth or where there were hieroglyphs all over in the middle of it. Wayne May and I have approximately 800 rune stones, some of which have all kinds of hieroglyphic cartouches, plain simple clear petroglyphs of Egyptian people. We have them in our possession.
Well, maybe the Ark was never meant to be found, Glenn.
I think it went home. I think it went home to be preserved for the coming of the Messiah. And that's just my own personal opinion, which is worth about as much as the next guy's personal opinion. But in my mind, it went home to where someday when this Messiah-like figure comes to this new Zion, whatever it is... And I don't know. I'm not a person who looks into prophecy or counts on prophecy or expounds on prophecy. But I suspect that this will be a significant site, and we'll find out that the Americas were reserved, periodically destroyed by cataclysms, but were reserved for peoples to come and experience freedom in a way they never had before. We certainly know that the discoveries in the Americas were discoveries of people with great trade ability. We know that that there were nine sarcophaguses in Egyptian mummies found in or from the German museums. They were studied. They did the toxicology on their hair, and all of their hair had cocaine in it. The cocaine could only have been grown in the Americas, and these were 2,500 years B.C. mummies. We know that they were all mummified with tobacco in their stomachs. The ancient trade routes were far more extensive than we give them credit for.
I wonder whoever it might have been who stumbled into the Americas, let's say it happened before Columbus, I wonder how that occurred. Was it? Do you think it was like a journey, a voyage, just to find out how far they could go? Or do you think there might have been a plan there?
I'm sure there was a plan. I'm sure it was on the trade route. If you go to Ipanema in Brazil, for example, we find Roman vessels from the first century shipwrecked right there in the Bay of Ipanema. What are Roman vessels doing there? We know very well what they are because of the pottery found in the wreckage. What are Roman vessels doing in the Ipanema Bay there in Brazil from the first century?
Exactly. And if they got that far, then you know they stumbled across us eventually.
Oh, yeah. And we were on the trade routes. We know that the Toltecs were great traders, the merchants. We know for a fact in this new find that they found of the pyramids at Carla in central Peru, this was a merchant town. This was amazing. This is going to bear on your Bosnian pyramid scenario too in just a moment. But these people were involved in world economies. They were not a warlike people. They were involved in trade. You could not grow crops in central Peru. I don't know if you've ever been to central Peru.
No, I have not, Clint.
But it doesn't ever rain. I mean, not one day a year, not a half an inch a year, never. I mean, it hasn't rained where I live for 200 years.
Yet it's pretty lush, isn't it?
Well, it's not lush at all.
No,
but how did they survive? How did
Peru
they
is not lush. I did not know that.
All yeah, right. Yeah. In these deserts there, nothing grew. So how did they survive?
Trade.
Yeah, with trade, and that's the only way they could have survived. And they traded worldwide, whether we like it or not. The Toltec societies, prior to the coming of the Aztecs, were built not on a warlike people or on a sacrificial bloodlust type of people, but they were built on a trading community. As a matter of fact, Ruth Shady, who developed the Carla site there, she's an anthropologist, her and her husband. She went there with the idea that all primitive societies who gathered into a city, they gathered into cities to protect themselves from being aggressed upon by war, by other peoples. And so cities were built based on a model of aggression. When she went to visit these pyramids in central Peru, she couldn't find a spear point. She couldn't find an arrow point. She couldn't find any defensive walls. She couldn't find one single weapon in this archaeological valley. So all of her anthropological theories about societies being developed based on a war model had to go out the window and be replaced with a model that says that society really was developed on trade. Our world was originally built on trade, and so it was in the Middle East as well. It was built upon trade. It has disintegrated, as did the model in Peru, disintegrated into jealousies and wars and rumors of wars and all those kind of things. In other words, we have been living exactly opposite of what the anthropologists have been telling us we have. We have begun our human existence with peace, trade, and prosperity, and great societies, and disintegrated into warlike people who are killing themselves off. It's amazing that human beings have survived their own warlike tendencies. It's amazing that we exist at all, because society tends to degenerate over a period of time. If you listen to the stories of Atlantis and Lemuria, Plato said that these people were eliminated because they violated the laws of the earth and of God. And that's why they were destroyed. They destroyed themselves. And if we're left to our own devices and we let terrorism and these kinds of things be the ultimate signature upon our script in history, we're not going to fare any better. Malachi's right. the guy that can curse the world, the almighty curser, you know, in the words of Bruce Almighty. I mean, the guy that could really smite us is going to smite us big time because he's done it before. You know, and that's sad.
You've been an expert in interpreting manuscripts. Are others seeing what you see, or are you standing alone out there?
Oh, I think they are. I think they are, especially those who, without doubt, they're. Well, there's some things that I do that other people don't do, and that's that I look at a larger picture of the world. Most of the historians segment out of a portion of the world and do history with that region specific. There's not many people out there to take a global picture of the world and try and connect the dots in all parts of the world. There are a few, but few and far between. But really, the world was connected. It always has been connected. We're intimately associated with each other. We depend upon each other for survival and always have depended upon each other for survival. The only societies that ever became wealthy and survived were societies that were built on trade, were built on exchange. The societies that lived in isolation were ultimately destroyed by cataclysm. You know?
Well, that's true. Why do all these civilizations seem to crop up, be dominant, and then they simply fade away? Why do they collapse? What happens to them?
I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy where we begin with great societies and that we degenerate into and are our own worst enemy. You know, people have asked me, what's the solution in the Middle East? You know? And I have kind of a real strong opinion about that, but it's not a traditional opinion about that. To be very candid with you, I call it the Boy Scout solution.
the Boy Scout solution? All right, now you've perked my interest. What is your solution?
Well, you know, in my neighborhood where the Boy Scouts were, we had bullies everywhere. I lived on the wrong side of the tracks, let me tell you. I mean, after every football game, there was a planned gang fight, okay?
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah.
And there were bullies that knocked everybody. You couldn't possibly survive without having belonging to a group, you know? I had to learn how to box and pick the biggest bully of the school out and knock him on his keister a couple of times before I even got any peace.
Yeah, that's the only way to get them to leave you alone.
However, those very same bullies were members of my scout troop.
Uh-huh.
Now, why did we ultimately become fast friends in the scout troop?
So you were friends in the scout troop, but not on the outside where
not
they
on
were the bullies. Until they changed.
Until they changed. And I'll tell you why. Because in the scout troop, we were able to play in the same arena. We were able to play the same game, do the same functions together.
You had a camaraderie.
We had a camaraderie. And what's wrong in the Middle East is the fact that we're not playing the same game. We're not playing the same economic game. This is critical, George. This is absolutely essential because the solution to the Middle East is not economic sanctions. It's economic development, and let me begin by speaking about the leading economists in the world will tell you that the Middle East does not have the same type of ownership we have in the West. If you were to go on if you own a house in the Middle East and you go on vacation, you come back and find someone living in your house, unless you have very powerful friends in the government. It's not easy to evict these people from your house.
They just move in?
They can move in. And so as a result, they don't have the county recorder, which has eminent domain over kicking you out if you're moving to somebody else's house. Jeez. And as a result, they do not have the same credit base to go to a bank and borrow on credit. You can't get a credit card as a common person in Saudi Arabia, for example, because you cannot get the same kind of hard asset verification that we would in a bank here.
Let's pick that up when we come back, Glenn. We'll pick that up and also talk about the Gospel of Judas and this incredible pyramid that's standing on a hill. It's up 2,300 feet in Bosnia. We'll be back.